regime of Israel. In doing so, the United States became the first country to recognize the Zionist regime's sovereignty over the occupied Syrian territory. 2 days after the Zionist regime's official annexation of the Golan Heights in 1981, the UN Security Council used Resolution 497 to determine the Knesset's Golan Heights law as null and void. Today, most of the international community considers the Golan Heights occupied. The Zionist regime decided to build a settlement in honor of Trump to be called Trump Heights as a thank you to the former president for his executive order. Trump Heights is part of the development plan to increase settler population in the Golan. While Trump's action altered the U.S. West Asia region strategy, it did not change the global status quo. Adala attorney Bishara reiterated, telling Mint Press News, "The declaration of the Trump administration in this regard did not change anything on the ground. It has, of course, its international implications in terms of how Israel perceives this acknowledgement. But in terms of international law, the annexation and any recognition by any state, including the U.S., does not change the status of the area as an occupied territory and the Syrian community there as a protected community under international humanitarian law." Al-Maqsad's founder and director, Nizar Ayyub, said that Trump's declaration increased settlement activity in the Golan, with many settlements adopting expansion projects. A few years ago, settlers were around 19,000 to 20,000. Now there are about 28,000 to 29,000 settlers, Ayyub said. But Trump's decision isn't the only factor speeding up settlement expansion efforts in the Golan. The Israelis are taking advantage of the situation going on in Syria and the destruction of the Syrian state. Wael Tarabia, director of Al-Marsat's Economic, Social and Cultural Rights Program, told Mint Press News, "So this is the opportunity that they are using to cement their grip on the Golan." After the Zionist regime occupied more than two-thirds of the Syrian Golan during the 1967 war, 95% of the population was displaced and banned from returning. The Zionist regime forces destroyed the area's infrastructure and built settlements using the rubble from the razed villages. But the speed at which the settlements expanded was slower than what the Zionist regime hoped. The heart of the Golan is almost empty because the policy of the settlers since the occupation was to go as far as possible toward the Syrian ceasefire line and to create facts on the ground there. Today, only 27,000 Syrians remain concentrated in five villages: Majdal Shams, Bogata, Masada, Ain, Aina, and Qajar in the northern Golan. Settlers and Syrians are approximately equal in the number now, but Al-Marsat's Tarbiya believes that the new settlement project will turn the Syrians into a demographic minority on their own land. He explained, "The main point is ignored and denied all the time, which is that the other Syrians who were uprooted from their lands count at more than 500,000 and no one is talking about them. No one is talking, for example, about the right of return for the Syrians as we talk about the Palestinians. That's why we call it a forgotten occupation. And everybody is treating the Golan as if it were a normal expansion of the Israeli place." And amid the crisis in Syria, the Golan Syrians are left without a voice. Tarabia said, "Because of what's happened in Syria in the last decade, the people here are helpless and they feel helpless. If you look at the local media, you will find that the reaction from the side of locals to the Israeli regime settlement plan is very few compared to what we used to see in the past years. And this explains that the people of the Golan, the Syrians, do not have any political support or representation." Thank you. Despite most of the global communities recognizing the Zionist regime's occupation of the Golan Heights as a violation of international law, the oppression is largely absent from international headlines. Adalah attorney Bishara surmised this is because public attention has been preoccupied with Syria's war, ongoing developments in the occupied Palestinian territories, and a raging pandemic. With the occupation of the Golan less of a violent land grab compared to the volatile situation in Palestine, the Zionist regime's injustice against Syrians gets pushed aside. As less focus is drawn to the issue from an international perspective, within the Zionist regime's cabinet, the occupation becomes further normalized. Bishara included, "It seems that the Golan Heights is becoming consensus because even Meretz, an Israeli left-wing political party, members voted in favor of this decision, which says that there is a consensus along with the whole spectrum of the Israeli political arena, from the right wing to the so-called left Zionist parties. Golan's remaining Syrian villages control less than 4% of their own land. This is because the Zionist regime designated the occupied Golan Heights as state land, meaning the Israeli regime determines its use. While turning some of it into military training fields and outposts, other portions were allocated as nature reserves and national parks, and the largest area is reserved for settlement development. A severe housing crisis emerged out of the Israeli-made land shortage, a problem that will only be exacerbated by the settlement plan. Discriminatory land policies have made it nearly impossible for Syrians to receive building permits, forcing them to build illegally and risk demolition orders. The Zionist regime authorities have issued 1,570 demolition orders since its annexation of the Golan. As a result, many Syrians have had to pay exorbitantly high fines, go to prison, or have their homes demolished." Al-Marsat Tarbiya speculated the settlement expansion plan may benefit local construction businesses, but overall, the Syrian Golanese economy will suffer. "The economic situation will become worse and worse with time," Tarbiya said, explaining how, along with settlement growth, the Zionist regime hopes to transform the Golan Heights into the Zionist regime's renewable energy capital. Last year, the Zionist regime approved a plan to build a giant wind farm on a fifth of the Syrian agricultural land in the Golan, significantly harming the natives' health, environment and economy, and depleting their natural resources. Tarbiya said, "That's why people feel that they can do nothing. We are a few people without any kind of support." But he argued that the Syrian communities are not in regular confrontation with the settlers, but rather the Zionist regime is their main source of friction. "When we talk about the housing crisis, people don't connect it directly to the settlers. They connect it to the policies of the Zionist regime, because we deal with the Zionist policies and Zionist authorities," Tarbiya said. "They are the ones who reject our need to expand the villages." Communique.
Russia has invaded Ukraine in what has been described as the largest conventional military attack in Europe since World War II. As of now, a million refugees have fled Ukraine. Russian forces have captured close to one-third of Ukraine's territory and are just miles away from the capital, Kiev. While some have abstained from condemning Russia's actions, others didn't shy away, slapping it with some of the toughest economic sanctions when Russia was partly removed from SWIFT and assets from its central bank were frozen. As the ruble plummeted, Russians headed to the ATMs to withdraw their savings. Now, while the corporate media would like you to believe that this whole issue is about Vladimir Putin being crazy, it's much bigger than that. He's actually quite rational. So what's his plan here? Why is Russia in Ukraine? Are its stated security concerns legitimate, or just a pretext for aggression? Has Putin really miscalculated, as we keep hearing? And is this operation worth the trouble? I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. In the early morning hours of February 24th, 2022, Russia launched what it called a special operation in Ukraine. President Putin gave a speech on television announcing the operation to, quote, demilitarize and denazify Ukraine. When Putin says denazify, he's likely talking about getting rid of neo-Nazi groups in Ukraine, such as the Azov Battalion. Its members idolize Stepan Bandera, a Nazi collaborator, and they also sport the Wolf's Angle, a symbol used by the Waffen-SS in World War II. What many in the West are calling an invasion came just a few days after Russia recognized two breakaway republics in eastern Ukraine, the Luhansk People's Republic, LPR, and the Donetsk People's Republic, DPR. Russia said that its hand was forced, that it had no choice but to take action to protect the ethnic Russians living in eastern Ukraine, which it claims were not only neglected, but even being killed by their government in Ukraine. Around 14,000 people have been killed during the last 8 years in the Donbass region. Russia also cited security concerns over NATO expansion. In December 2021, Russia put forward a list of demands, asking that Ukraine be prevented from joining the North Atlantic Treaty Organization and that the Western Military Alliance return NATO forces to 1997 positions. The West ignored these demands, calling them non-starters. And the offensive on February 24th immediately drew widespread condemnation and economic sanctions. Russia was subsequently removed from SWIFT, also known as Society for Worldwide Interbank Financial Telecommunication. Basically, what SWIFT is, it's an integral part of the world economy. SWIFT doesn't actually transfer any money. It's more of a messaging network for banks that relay money transfer orders. So frankly speaking, SWIFT is crucial for any country to participate in the world economy. There are over 11,000 banks in 200 countries that are connected to SWIFT. And by targeting Russian banks, this makes it extremely difficult for Russian companies to receive money for their exports or pay for their imports. It cuts revenue to Russia. You can't have a revenue stream if you can't make or receive payments. Now, the only banks that did manage to escape the SWIFT ban were the ones handling energy-related payments. Why? Because Europeans don't want to freeze. Russia supplies around 40% of Europe's gas, and if Europeans can't pay the Russians anymore for gas, well, they're the ones who are going to get hit the hardest. Now, another target of these Western sanctions was the Central Bank of Russia. Russia's central bank has just about $630 billion worth of foreign currency and gold. But half of it is not in Russia, it's overseas. And now it cannot be accessed anymore. Russia's been locked out. So this would prevent, for example, the Russian bank from using its foreign exchange reserves in order to stabilize the Russian currency, the ruble. And when trading began the morning of February 27th, the ruble, as expected, plummeted by 30%, meaning one ruble was now worth one US cent, not a dollar, a cent. And so Russians could be seen queuing up in front of ATMs in mile-long queues in what are known as bank runs. That's when people rush to the banks, they run to the banks to withdraw their money during an economic crisis. Now, in an emergency move to try and mitigate the situation, Russia's central bank raised the key interest rate from 9.5% to 20%, and Russian exporters were also ordered to convert 80% of their foreign currency earnings to rubles to shore up the currency. Now, in response to these sanctions, President Putin ordered that Russia's deterrence forces, another way of saying its nuclear forces, be put on high alert. Now, in addition to targeting Russia with economic warfare, the West has also turned to arming Ukraine. Now, back in January, the United States sent Ukraine $200 million worth of weapons. 2 days after the beginning of the operation, On February 26th, Biden approved another package, this time $350 million in military aid for Ukraine. Now, in addition to canceling the Nord Stream 2 pipeline project between Russia and Germany, in a sharp turn, Germany said that it would also start sending weapons to Ukraine, including 1,000 anti-tank weapons and 500 Stingers. Now, another significant development came when the European Union also decided to send Ukraine weapons. This is the first time in history that the EU intervenes in a conflict in such a way, choosing to arm one side. And now, speaking of arms, the Ukrainian embassy in the Czech Republic even went and set up a donation page for people to pitch in to help the Ukrainians buy guns. Yeah. The Ukrainian defense minister went on Twitter and asked foreigners to come to Ukraine and fight. Liz Truss, the British Foreign Secretary, she not only approved of this plan, but she encouraged people on television to go join the fight in Ukraine.
President Zelensky has asked for people from abroad to join an international force. Would you support that?
I do support that. And of course, that is something that people can make their own decisions about. But they are fighting. The people of Ukraine are fighting for freedom and democracy, not just for Ukraine, but for the whole of Europe, because that is what President Putin is challenging.
So apparently the UK government is totally fine with people going off to Ukraine and fighting alongside neo-Nazis. It sees no problem with that. While NATO has made it clear that they won't set up a no-fly zone, that hasn't stopped journalists and pundits calling for one incessantly like a bunch of chicken hawks. Now, a no-fly zone, like what happened in Libya, as an example, would mean that any Russian jet in the air would be shot down by NATO. And this could easily and very likely lead and escalate to a nuclear war between Russia and the West. If you go watch CNN or BBC right now, you would be under the impression that the Russian offensive in Ukraine is a complete disaster. But that's not what the map says. If we take a close look at what's going on right now, we can see that the Russian troops are displayed in red, and they're doing what is known as a pincer movement. This is a classic move in military tactics and strategy. And so if the Russian forces in the south link up with the ones in the north, they will effectively split Ukraine in half. And this would cause all kinds of logistical and strategic disasters for the Ukrainians. Now, to bolster this narrative that Russia is being destroyed in Ukraine, we've even seen fake videos going around on social media and even posted by large news outlets. This viral video allegedly showing a dogfight where a Russian plane is shot down by a Ukrainian plane turned out to be fake. It's from a video game from Arma 3. Other stories like the Snake Island tale or the Ghost of Kiev, these also turned out to be completely fake stories. And in addition to all this, the West has been waging an information war. The EU moved to ban the Russian news outlet RT and its sister company Sputnik. So this means that people in the EU can no longer watch RT. They can't watch it online, nor on television, nor through apps on their mobile phones. And if you go on RT's YouTube channel, this is what you see. A message that reads, "This channel is not available in your country." All of RT's Twitter posts are hidden by a label now, preventing anyone from reading the text. You cannot even see the profile picture. Following the ban, RT America laid off all of its staff. Several shows were canceled. Podcasts were removed by Spotify and other carriers. I mean, let's not kid ourselves. We all know what's going on and what this is. This is a witch hunt, and it's straight up censorship. It's just like when Press TV was taken off the air by Ofcom in the UK, or when the Biden administration stole Press TV's domain name, taking down the website entirely. It is a clear-cut attack on the press and those with differing viewpoints. I mean, the madness doesn't stop there, though, because Russia is being boycotted on all levels to the point that it's hurting ordinary Russian citizens that have absolutely nothing to do with the decisions of the Kremlin. This restaurant sign in Portugal reads, "We do not serve Russians." And so now they're boycotting Russian cats, trees, even Russian composers like Tchaikovsky. Canadian officials even stopped a plane just because it had Russian passengers on board. So they're essentially taking them hostage just for being Russian. Russia's been kicked out of the Eurovision Song Contest. The Champions League final was moved from St. Petersburg to Paris. Warner Brothers, Disney, and Sony have all decided not to release any more of their films to Russian cinemas. I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous because this is all purely performative rubbish and so typical of Western neoliberalism. It doesn't accomplish anything. And so many people have been cheering on Ukrainians taking up arms and resisting the Russians. You know, people were posting and sharing videos online about how to make Molotov cocktails. On Twitter, BBC's Jeremy Bowen posted a guide on how to destroy Russian tanks with Molotov cocktails. You know, I wonder what would happen if someone posted a guide showing Palestinians how to destroy Israeli tanks or showing Iraqis how to destroy American tanks. People would immediately call that terrorism and Twitter would just take down the picture. And look at the double standard in how they treat refugees. You know, all of these European countries, especially Poland, Hungary, Moldova, Romania, Bulgaria, you know, they were saying, we're not taking in any more refugees and treating refugees like rubbish at the border. And now, suddenly, they're saying, we're going to take in refugees with open arms. Send us all the Ukrainians. I mean, and it's not just the governments who are saying this. Listen to this clip. Look how the journalists, the reporters, try and justify this brazen double standard.
This isn't a place, with all due respect, you know, like Iraq or Afghanistan that has seen conflict raging for decades. You know, this is a relatively civilized, relatively European, I have to choose those words carefully too, city where you wouldn't expect that or hope that it's going to happen.
Now the unthinkable has happened to them. And this is not a developing third world nation. This is Europe.
It's really emotional for me because I see European people with blue eyes and blonde hair being killed, children being killed every day.
It's absolutely shocking and despicable. And speaking of racism, African and Indian and Greek students were posting on Twitter how they were prevented from leaving Ukraine to Poland, despite the border being wide open for everyone trying to escape the war zone, right? So it's okay for the Ukrainians to leave the war zone, but the Africans, the people of color, they have to stay in the war zone. I mean, I've never seen anything like that. It's unbelievable. And on that note, we saw on Twitter how the official account of the Ukrainian National Guard posted a video from the neo-Nazi Azov battalion greasing its bullets in pork fat, saying that it's keeping these to kill Muslims from Chechnya, which it referred to as orcs. I mean, if you had any doubts left in your mind about the neo-Nazis and the racism in Ukraine, well, here you go. That's the official account of the Ukrainian National Guard saying this stuff right there out in the open in English. It's completely, completely shameless.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Joining me now is Diliana Gaitanjeva, a Bulgarian investigative journalist and Middle East correspondent. She's also the founder of Arms Watch, which is an independent investigative journalism platform that tracks weapons and documents war crimes. Diliana, it's my pleasure to welcome you on the program. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you for having me.
The first thing I wanted to ask you is, could I just get your initial thoughts on what's happening in Ukraine? What do you think of the whole issue? Because this invasion or operation, as the Russians are calling it, it caught a lot of people by surprise. What do you think of Russia's justification for going into Ukraine? And, you know, how long do you think they will be staying there?
As a Bulgarian, for me, it wasn't a surprise at all. Bulgaria borders on the Black Sea, which borders on Russia and Ukraine. We have a lot of Bulgarians living in Donetsk and in Ukraine. And over the years, the Bulgarian population living in Ukraine was subjected to a lot of, I would say, put it that way, atrocities by Ukrainian neo-Nazis I will give an example. For instance, the Bulgarian flag was taken down. The Bulgarian cultural center in Odessa was burned. And Bulgarians inside this center, they were burned alive in 2014. And they frequently publish videos of them burning alive people simply for being other ethnicity, ethnic group, groups, or for being, as they call them, traitors and separatists. These neo-Nazis, these far-right groups, they were funded, armed, tolerated, and trained by the West. They became an integral part of the ruling of Ukraine. The other part of the problem is the fact that the Ukrainian president, Zelensky, he declared his wish for Ukraine to become a nuclear power and to develop nuclear weapons.
What would you say to people who say that, well, yeah, there are neo-Nazis in Ukraine, but it's just a minority and it's not representative of the government or the army? What do you respond to them?
How do you know that this is not a problem? Are they in Ukraine now? I have been a war correspondent for quite some time, and what I have seen myself in many places, in all conflicts that I have covered, in Libya, in Gaza, and in Syria, the first victim, the first casualty of every war, this is the truth. What I have seen, and I can give many examples, for instance, in Syria, we are a group of journalists, including Western journalists, for instance, CNN, and we cover one and the same event. How is that we show and film the same people and interview the same people, and in the end, when you see the reports, for instance, of CNN, they show totally different report, and they distort the reality. So I have seen this myself. I don't believe them. So these people who say that the neo-Nazis, they are not a problem, how do they know that? Do they are they on the ground? Did they talk to local people?
And Diliana, because you covered the war in Syria, and you just mentioned a few moments ago how there was such a disparity between what you were reporting and what CNN, for example, was reporting, even though you were covering the exact same story. Do you feel that right now with what's happening in Ukraine, there's also a similar disparity with what was happening in Syria between what's happening on the ground and what's being reported in the mainstream media?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's why I don't rely on the media now to be informed on what is happening. Because I can give many examples in which videos that were published by people in Donbas, this is the area that is populated with the Russian population, and that had been shelled, bombed for 8 years now. So the videos that were taken in Donbas, they are presented as videos taken in Ukraine now. And I can give many, many, many examples. So always fake now.
So in terms of international law, you know, there are basically two arguments here. There's one side saying that this is a violation of Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity. And again, funnily enough, these people, they never care, for example, when Syria is being bombed by Israel. But nevertheless, they make this argument. And then there's another argument that Russia is acting in self-defense, you know, for example, under Article 51 of the UN Charter. So, and of course, there's the intelligence that was brought forward about an imminent threat, the NATO expansion. So, I mean, how do we reconcile these things, you know, with Russia acting in self-defense, but also Ukraine maintaining its sovereignty?
I think the legality issues or in our world now, the legality of whatever action they perform, it doesn't matter anymore. Have you seen anybody talking about the legality of the American invasion in Iraq, Afghanistan, the killing of Gaddafi, Saddam Hussein, etc., etc.? I absolutely understand the Ukrainian people, the refugees that have to leave their country now, that live in underground basements to protect themselves. Of course, they suffer. This is war. On the other hand, I also understand the arguments which Russia presented. They are acting in self-defense because these are Russian people that have been bombarded on a daily basis, 24/7, day in, day out, for 8 years. And on the other hand, I also understand the other argument about the nuclear threat, about the NATO expansion, which is existential threat. I think every country would react the same way if that country has the capabilities that Russia has.
Now, regardless what you think of Russia, whether you believe that Russia's acting in self-defense and it has legitimate security concerns, or you believe that Russia is purely an aggressor, there is a silver lining to this whole Ukraine crisis. And what is the silver lining? It's that we have exposed now the hypocrisy of the West. All of a sudden, taking up arms and fighting an invading force or an occupying force is glorified in the West, right? But when Palestinians do it, they call them terrorists. And people are even buying the weapons for the Ukrainians. You know, you can go online and crowdfund weapons for Ukraine. If you donated to Hamas or you tried to buy weapons for the Palestinian resistance, you would be thrown into jail. Okay? End of story. You would be put on a list and called a terrorist. And then they talk about sovereignty and territorial integrity. Really, where's their respect for Syria's sovereignty and Syria's territorial integrity, right? The Americans stealing the oil, Israel occupying the Golan Heights, bombing Syria virtually every week. I don't hear anything about sovereignty when that happens. And the same countries that invaded Iraq, invaded Afghanistan, bombed Libya, bombed Yugoslavia, they have the nerve now to talk about aggression. This is some of the most blistering, blinding hypocrisy that I've ever seen in my life. And even when it comes to refugees, they are openly saying that Ukrainians are somehow worth more because they're white and Christian, right? I mean, they don't even bother hiding their racism anymore. They're just so shameless saying these things on camera like it's nothing. And you know, if we're going to boycott every Russian thing imaginable ever because of Ukraine, very good, great. So where's the boycott of U.S. athletes and films and music and art and food after the U.S. invaded Iraq or Syria or destroyed Libya? Huh? You know, those people, they don't matter because they're not white? How come all of these embassies and monuments in the West, they don't put up the Arab colors on their buildings? Why all of this outrage over Ukraine, but nothing, not a word, it's not even comparable, right? When the U.S. and NATO, they commit far worse crimes. We don't hear a word. And again, it's so sad what's happening in Ukraine. It's an extremely regrettable situation. And the worst part is that it could have totally been avoided through diplomacy with a few phone calls. You know, the West, they dangled NATO membership in front of Ukraine for years just for the sake of antagonizing Russia. And when the bear finally wakes up, they run away and leave Ukrainians holding the bag. You see how NATO, they won't risk their own. They're not ready to enter the fight. They're just sending some guns to Ukraine and saying, hey, you're on your own. Ukrainians, they're the ones left paying the price just so NATO could try and put a few more missiles closer to Russia. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
Is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
Despite the illegal U.S. sanctions, or more properly, intense economic terrorism, the Iranian people, with their patience, resilience, and spirit of sacrifice, have made the plots of their enemies go awry, to the extent that they are models of emulation for the masses and the independent governments of the region and beyond, which seek the Islamic Republic's positive influence to the chagrin of the U.S. and its surrogates, says Kahan, international staff writer, in an article published under the heading Keys to Iran's National Strength. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Reports from Vienna say the talks between Iran and the 4+1 group of big powers are on hold because of unspecified external factors, which means the United States, which is not a party to the talks because of its illegal withdrawal from the 2015 Geneva Accord, is not serious in rejoining the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, that requires Washington to remove all the sanctions that were illegally imposed on the Islamic Republic by both the Donald Trump regime and the previous one of Barack Obama. This is proof of the fact that the U.S., the cause of crises all over the world, remains the enemy of Iran and the Iranian people, and will resort to any unprincipled move to what it thinks would undermine the progress of the Islamic Republic. Does this mean Tehran should bow to blackmail in the misconstrued hope that the great Satan would give up its devilry and allow the Iranian people a bit of relief from what it thinks has reduced them to misery Absolutely not, since such a self-humiliating approach is tantamount to placing the fate of the country in the hands of its chief foe and becoming a satellite state of the U.S., as was pre-revolution Iran during the despotic rule of the British-installed Pahlavi regime. So, what is the solution? Is there any remedy for Iran to safeguard its hard-earned independence and remain master of its own affairs with firm resolve to continue the path charted out by the father of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon his soul, to whom Iran owes its present power and prestige in the region and the world? Of course, there is thanks to the able leadership of late Imam's worthy successor, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, to whom Iranian people are indebted for their mastering of the intricacies of modern science and technology, including the nuclear fuel cycle, aerospace, missile power, the cyber field, and artificial intelligence. Yes, despite the illegal U.S. sanctions, or more properly, intense economic terrorism, the Iranian people, with their patience, resilience, and spirit of sacrifice, have made the plots of their enemies go awry, to the extent that they are models of emulation for the masses and the independent governments of the region and beyond, which seek the Islamic Republic's positive influence to the chagrin of the U.S. and its surrogates. Thus, what is important for us is not the revival of any flawed accord that binds our hands or reaching a new agreement that curtails our inalienable right to explore new vistas of peaceful nuclear energy. But, as Ayatollah Khamenei recently said, what is of significance to Iran is increasing national strength on the basis of Islamic concepts to build a flourishing economy, undeterred by external factors, ensuring a strong security and defense to protect the Islamic Republic and its independence, and a strategic engagement in regional affairs to thwart the transgression of outside powers. To some, it is these brilliant guidelines of the leader of the Islamic Revolution, for whom the economic welfare of the people is tied to diplomatic strength and bargaining power for ensuring national interest at the regional and global levels, an indomitable defense industry, and an appealing logic that influences other nations and brings a strategic depth to the country, which are keys to Iran's national strength.
Welcome back. We met Javad Qarai, an enthusiastic young nature explorer, and followed him as he discovered some of Iran's most unspoiled natural attractions in the southern province of Sistan and Balochistan. We visited the exotic Martian mountains with their peculiar shapes and ventured deep into the intertwining and spiral cave of the region. And finally, we joined Javad as he gazed into the mesmerizing waters of the Sea of Oman above the rocky cliffs. Stay with us as we further explore the wonders of the region and meet the kind-hearted locals.
The area is so beautiful and unspoiled. It is home to large flocks of birds, such as the cormorant sitting on the sandy beaches offering a scenic spectacle. It is the perfect place for birdwatchers to come and feast their eyes on these exotic animals. Birdwatching is a branch of tourism, or to be exact, ecotourism. Birdwatchers are steadily growing in number. Cormorants are aquatic birds. They are medium to large in size, with a body weight in the range of 0.35 to 5 kilograms and a wingspan of 45 to 100 centimeters. The majority of the species have dark feathers. They are excellent divers, and underwater, they propel themselves with their feet with help from their wings. Some cormorant species have been found to dive as deep as 45 meters. Cormorants nest in colonies around the shore, on trees, islets, or cliffs. They are coastal rather than oceanic birds, and some have colonized inland waters. Indeed, the original ancestor of cormorants seems to have been a freshwater bird. In my previous trips here, I saw large flocks of these beautiful birds here in this season. But this time, there aren't so many of them. One of the reasons behind the decline in their populations is because some of the locals hunt and eat them. Although cormorants are not supposed to be eaten because they are carnivorous. According to some religious scholars, flesh-eating birds are not to be eaten. The flesh of carnivorous birds may contain many diseases that can be passed on to humans if eaten, but the locals are not aware of that. Those who hunt the cormorants do not do so because there is nothing else to eat, so they have no reason to kill and consume so many of these poor birds and do irreparable damage to the wildlife and environment in the region. The environment and wildlife are manifestations of God's beauty. How can humans, who consider themselves the greatest of creations, allow themselves to harm the manifestations of God's beauty? Human survival on the planet Earth inevitably depends on the environment and on the wildlife. Therefore, our country's officials should educate the local populations and make sure that the environment in each and every part of the country is well taken care of. This has been a very beautiful day for me. Barrie East is one of the most beautiful places I have visited, and I have visited many over the years. A day later, I'm on my way to a beautiful village in the heart of nature, accompanied by my good friend, Sheer Muhammad Rahul. To get to Shame Kohne, that's the name of the village, we have to walk a relatively long way surrounded by beautiful natural beauties. Near the village, we run into a shepherd named Sheer Muhammad, sitting under an old leafless tree by a pond. His is the simplest of lifestyles. The Baluch mainly speak the Baluchi language, a branch of northwestern Iranian languages. Experts say the Baluch language is very similar to that of the Medes, a people of Indo-Iranian origin, who inhabited the western and northwestern portion of present-day Iran. And that is a testimony to the deep roots of the Baluch tribe in Iran. Today, the Baluch people live in the southwest of Iran, the south of Pakistan, Afghanistan, Oman, India, the UAE, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, and Zanzibar. Borders between countries haven't been able to separate members of this ancient Iranian tribe. Although they live in different countries, the Baluch have preserved their traditions. They pay each other visits, and intertribal marriages are common. The Shahnameh and several other old books have placed the dwelling place of the Baluch people at around the north of modern-day Khorasan province, For various reasons, this peace-loving, serene tribe have had to move here, the southeast of Iran, and lived in peace since. Shir Muhammad Baluch is one of the original members of the old Sham village. But today, the village is nothing more than a collection of abandoned buildings where he can rest during sizzling hot days. This is amazing. They place one lantern and both families lived under the light of that one lantern. There isn't much left of the old Sham village, but even the ruins of it speak of the very rich culture of the kind, hospitable Baluch people. One of the structures that has stood the test of time is the beautiful mosque of Old Sham, built by the very hands of those who inhabited the village many years ago. It's gotten unbearably hot by now. I am kilometers away from the coast of the Sea of Oman in Baluchistan. But that distance is not going to keep me from a much-needed dive on the golden sand beach. The difference between the temperatures in Iran's climate zones is incredible, and to many, unbelievable. I'm in the southeasternmost part of Iran, swimming in the Sea of Oman in the middle of winter. On this same day, some of my mountaineer friends climbing up Mount Damavand tell me the temperature where they are is around minus 30 degrees. That's a difference of 60 degrees between two areas of Iran. I've done my swimming, and now I've decided to travel to the southeastern end of Iranian territory. That's the Gwadar Bay, located in the Gulf of Oman on the maritime border of Iran and Pakistan. A lot of fish is caught and brought to shore here. Many large trawler launches unload their catches on smaller boats on the shore. Before they arrive in Iranian territory, the fish coming from those launches are purchased by middlemen and transported to big cities around the country. The main purpose of my trip to Gwadar Bay is to see the beautiful Hara mangrove forest in this border area. Hara is a species of the Lantana genus, The seeds from the tree fall into the water, where wave action takes them to more stationary parts of the sea. The Haro seeds become fixed in the soil layers of the sea and grow. Haro trees are saltwater plants that are often submerged at high tide. They are salt-tolerant trees and are adapted to life in harsh coastal conditions. They contain a complex salt filtration system and a complex root system to cope with saltwater immersion and wave action. They are adapted to the low oxygen conditions of waterlogged mud. We are now exactly at the mouth of Khure Bahu. This is the zero point that separates Iran from Pakistan. We are about to enter a very beautiful river. As a matter of fact, it's a khur or firth, it's not a river. And it continues a long way in that direction. Khure Bahu is in fact a bay area created by water from the Sea of Oman. This is the last spot before you actually arrive in the sea itself. Before the firth, there is the Bahu Kalat River that flows from Sarbaz Mountains to the Gulf of Oman. This is it. I can see the mountains of Pakistan vividly from here. Pakistan is located right on the other side of the Hara Forest. A lot of birds and fish live here in this firth, which, as I said, was created by salty waters from the Sea of Oman. It's a very beautiful area. The Hara forests spanning this area are indeed unique. The Hara tree grows to heights of 6 meters and has bright green leaves and twigs. It is a species of the mangrove tree that can grow in coastal saline or brackish water. They have a complex salt filtration system and complex root system to cope with saltwater immersion and wave action. The Hara excludes salt by having significantly impermeable roots, which are highly impregnated with suberin, acting as an ultrafiltration mechanism to exclude sodium salts from the rest of the plant. Hara trees grow in 8 protected areas in Iran and are fortunately looked after by both the authorities and people. The Hara forests in the south of Iran are a major habitat for migratory birds in the cold season and for reptiles, fish, and varieties of bivalves. Green or hooked turtles and venomous aquatic snakes are also indigenous to the forests. Bird life includes herons, flamingos, pelicans, and angler eagles. Another important feature of these forests is the appropriate and suitable seabed conditions for the ovulation of fish in the Persian Gulf. The locals say you are very likely to run into a school of dolphins passing Gwadar Bay on your way to see the Hara forests. But looks like I'm down on my luck today. There are still many villages in Baluchistan that have weathered the storm of time and preserved their traditional look. But the way to visit one of them is to seek guidance from a local guide. And that person is none other than my very own friend, Shir Muhammad. We have a long way ahead of us to the village we have decided to visit. To get there, we have to drive on a vast plain. There are no paved roads, not so much as a dirt track. The name of the village is Nilak. Baluchistan is a very dry province. It rains very little here. As a result, not very long ago, the people of Baluchistan would dig a catchment to accumulate what little rainwater that fell from the sky. Those catchments acted as their only water reservoirs. They called them hutags. The importance of drinking water is not lost on anyone nowadays. Aware of the shortage of this vital liquid, countries around the world have embarked on preserving and conserving drinking water in recent years. The best way to prevent water from going to waste in a country like Iran that's facing a severe water problem is changing the consumption pattern. Put it simply, Every human being needs only 10 liters of water to wash their whole body. But most of us keep the water running while having a shower and let something between 100 and 200 liters